Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Ben Connolly, and I am really happy to get to introduce our guest speaker, Pamela Ayo Yetunde. Goes by Ayo, middle name. And Ayo is a community Dharma leader in the Insight Meditation tradition. She's a regular, has contributed many articles to Lion's Roar magazine.
Just one.
I read multiple ones.
Those were in Buddha Dharma.
Oh, okay, well, Buddha Dharma. You can just keep correcting me.
Okay.
Director of Interreligious Chaplaincy at the United Theological Seminary, which is a long-standing seminary in the northern part of the Twin Cities. A chaplain in private practice as well. I just found out she moved here, and now she's going to go away for the fall already because she's going to Harvard to do a postdoc fellowship. That sounds pretty cool. But I think maybe the thing that really gets me is the project she started, which is the Theology of Prince. So if anyone would like to contribute any kind of articles or poetry to the Theology of Prince project, you're talking to the right person. And I can't resist just submitting this. All seven and we'll watch them fall. They stand in the way of love and we will smoke them all. So
go, Ben. Go, Ben.
So my great pleasure... Pamela, I'm right.
Thank you. Good morning. So I'm nervous, and I also have a little bit of grief. I just have to let you know that up front. I've been kind of teary lately. I had a death in my family, which is causing a lot of changes, and so I'm feeling, and the cold brings that on too. I moved here from Atlanta, so I'm still adjusting. And with all that, I'm happy to be here. And thank you for inviting me, and thank you for letting me be here with you. So it's my understanding, typically in a Dharma talk, someone is bringing something, and they have the authority to bring it, and that those who are listening should listen carefully because it's going to be deep and wise and maybe transformative. And I want to say that I don't think I'm going to bring all that today. So just let go of any expectations you may have. And I'd like to have a conversation rather than give a standard Dharma talk. Is that okay?
Sure.
No conversation? Okay, good. Because when I looked at the title of this talk, I said, I cannot believe that I said I was going to talk about that. What was I thinking? I haven't even earned the right to enter into such dangerous political waters with this group of strangers, and they don't know me and I don't know them, and this could be a terrible idea. And also, I think the situation politically has gotten worse. And so it's worthy of talking about, I think, in large part because of the, how can I say, the ugliness that has bubbled up and is spreading and is causing us as a nation to turn against each other. And I don't think by not talking about these hard things to talk about, controversial things to talk about, that's going to help the situation. So, with that, maybe we can tiptoe into this, and I'll say a little bit about myself, and then as a way of establishing rapport, or at least attempting to, then maybe you can say something about yourself, right? So it's just not me talking about me and not knowing anything about you, and you not having an opportunity to share about yourself. Or yourselves. Is that all right? Okay. If that's okay, then who would like to begin sharing something either about yourself or about your community? Thank you.
I'm Ross. I usually go by Ross because it's easier. And I'm pretty new here. Moved from Milwaukee, but I'm originally from Moscow, and I'm sort of here to learn.
Thank you, Taras. You're not safe back there. In case I will bring this with a microphone back there. Do you want to come up so people can see you? Okay.
I'm Lisa.
Hey, Lisa.
And my community is loving and welcoming.
Great.
And I have to be a part of it.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Our community is really open, and we like listening and we like sharing, and I'm grateful that you're here, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. One more for now? Okay. Roger.
I'm Roger, and I went to Lafayette last night, and for the first time in seemingly a long time, I was really inspired by the joy and of people getting together and just simply being outside and enjoying just incredible art. And it was, that community spirit was really inspiring. Made me proud.
Thank you. Thank you, Roger. And I saw a hand back here.
I was hoping Amy would say this, but I saw the title of your Dharma talk today, and about a year ago, she and her husband Jim sort of asked a question of the group here if we needed to have a sort of subgroup to talk about what's going on in politics and the country, and we did. It's not officially associated with this Sangha in any way, but it just happens to be people who met each other here, and it's been good. So I think don't be afraid of your own topic.
Okay.
You've got to get more people here who are interested in hearing.
Thank you. Thank you. What's your name?
Bernie.
Bernie?
Sorry.
Okay, Bernie. Thank you. All right, thank you, and I am still afraid. But thank you, and thank you for letting me know this is a loving and welcoming community. Okay, a little bit about myself. So maybe I don't look like the typical Buddhist practitioner, in that I mean I'm of African descent. And I had my first encounters with Buddhism when I was living in Oakland, California. And it was 2001, and it was October. And George W. Bush had declared that the United States was going to retaliate for the attack on the World Trade Center. And for the first time in my life, I felt an anxiety that I hadn't felt before. I was turning 40 and was planning a birthday party, and I just thought, you know, I don't want gifts. It's nothing that anybody can give me is going to be really meaningful to me, because I'm just not feeling well. So I said, bring me peace. Bring me peace of mind. If you can bring me that, I would greatly appreciate that. So one of my friends gave me a copy of Thich Nhat Hanh's Touching Peace. Mm-hmm. And that coincided also with my acceptance into the Zen Hospice Project volunteer program. So those two things kind of came together in very powerful ways. I was able to begin feeling at peace. I was able to confront my fears around death and dying through Buddhist practices. And this speaks to me. This is it for me. And so that was 2001. I've been practicing in the Insight tradition primarily since then. And also, I practiced with a Zen group, a breakoff group, a rebel group, a rogue Zen group in Atlanta for about 2 years. And I had an experience there that has often led me to wonder about this thing called moral equivalency. Some people call it that. Other people say, you know, there's no right, there's no wrong. Others, it's empty, devoid of intrinsic isness. And I experienced that in that particular sangha when I felt that I had been the victim of racism. I expressed anger about it, and the reaction was, you know, that's the reason why you're angry is because you're attached to your views and all this kind of stuff. We're not responsible for our behavior and our actions. And so this is, it had me thinking. So also, I have been following the political situation from the debates. I watched almost every Republican debate. I watched almost every Democratic debate. I watched what was aired from the Republican National Convention. I watched what was aired at the Democratic National Convention. And I was talking to my friends and family all the while, many of them just as intelligent as everybody in this room, not believing that Trump could win. And if you know anything about the power of celebrity and wealth and the combination of those two things and his access to the press and saw the falling away of credible Republican contenders, then one could see how he could win. And it was very frightening to me. That was actually more frightening to me than the aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center, because I could see the coming out of the woodwork, the racists, and we've seen it just come to that. You know, I never heard of the word Antifa. Had you heard of that word until recently? Antifa, A-N-T-I-F-A, anti-fascists. That in the United States, they are anti-fascists activists who are countering racists in the street fighting, which is what was happening in Charlottesville, has happened on the campus of UC Berkeley and other campuses. So this is kind of like a new world in the United States where we have to decide whether we are pro or against fascism in the United States. That's where we are. And to pretend that we're not there may contribute to them having more power than they should have. So when Trump said that there are bad people on both sides as it related to the collision of values, if you will, in people in Charlottesville, something in that struck a nerve in me. Like, I've heard that kind of talk before in a Zen group. I've heard that. And so that's why I titled this talk, The Zen of Trump, in case you were wondering. Because I'm sure you're thinking, ain't nothing Zen about this guy. Right? He does not embody Zen. He does not speak Zen. He doesn't look Zen. There's nothing Zen about him. However, he does seem to have a way of knowing when in public it is not in his interest to take a side. For example, I don't know if you remember when he was hosting Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the question from the reporter or the journalist was, you know, do you believe in a two-state solution for Palestine and Israel? And Trump said, I believe in I believe in what both parties want. And Netanyahu began laughing. Do you remember that? And he said, this is the art of the deal, right? And just began to laugh. And then there's another time, which I think is very similar to this I don't want to call it Zen anymore because it becomes offensive after a while. This way of not taking a side or being portraying himself as neutral around Judge Roy Moore running for Senate. Now, all the evidence suggests that Roy Moore was a pedophile. And people wanted to know, Trump, are you going to endorse him? There was silence. And then there was, Moore denies it all, so you've got to listen to him too. And I'm thinking that's what you wanted regarding all the accusations against you, right? You denied it, and you just want people to hear that. Then ultimately he endorsed Moore. He did take a side. So I raise all of this to say, I think Buddhist communities can do better than this. To stay in the, it's all the same. There's no good, there's no bad. Because if compassion is central to what we are about, and that's regardless of lineage, right? Theravada, Mahayana, compassion is central. Is that right? I just want to check. It's central to what we're about, the cultivation of compassion and being compassionate in the world. Then we are going to have to take sides sometimes in the interest of the cultivation of compassion and being a refuge for people who are hurting, who've been hurt, who are being hurt. But how do we know when it's appropriate to do that if we're so inclined to take a side and take a stand and stand in that? How do we know? And that's the conversation I want to have, because I don't know if I know. I think about it a lot. Sometimes I think I know. But in coming here, I'm thinking, I don't think that I know. And even if I did know, who would I be to try to impose my knowledge, my realization, my actualization around this on others? I'm no one to do that. So, my question to you all, to this community, is, is there something that we need to do, think, say, feel, practice, interpret suttas or sutras that can have a rehabilitative effect or impact on trying to figure out if I want to say this way. On our collective aversion to conflict.
Sorry, I missed the last word. Collective aversion to
conflict.
Thank you.
To the best of my ability. I'll state it another way. Jill, is that right? Lisa. I'm sorry. I've read a few articles and books by people who critique Buddhism on different levels. One critique is that Buddhists and Buddhism has an embedded attachment anxiety. Okay. I don't agree with that, but okay, it's been out there. It's been said. I think when I think about our culture in the United States in particular, and it's true in other Buddhist communities, that there's a there's an aversion to conflict. And that we can use this moral equivalency as a justification for not entering into conflict, because it would require us to say something is negative, positive, bad, good, evil, what have you. And so, if that's true, is there something about who we are, what we do, how we engage in the sutras that can have a rehabilitative effect so that we can become clearer about morality? Lisa, does that make sense the way I put it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's loaded. Okay. So let me try one more time. Do we need to be about the business of rehabilitating our teachings and practices? I saw a hand.
Yeah.
And would you say your name, please?
My name is Sherry. I think that possibly part of the aversion to conflict that I think could be inherent to Buddhism maybe comes from the cultures from which Buddhism came, because spiritual practice is just going to be, you know, those traditions and ways of being are going to be influenced by the culture that it grew out of. And then also add to that, U.S. culture, Midwestern culture especially, we already have our inherent aversions to conflict, so it's sort of layers upon layers of that aversion. And I think that bringing the cultivation of compassion and bringing it back to the teachings of right speech and right action, I think that maybe the teachings don't necessarily themselves need to be rehabilitated, but changing our relationship with right speech and right action so that we can actualize the compassion that we're cultivating, to actually bring it to our behavior, not just our heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the teachings are still have what we need. It's changing how we're engaging with them.
Okay. All right. So can I ask a follow-up question?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Keeping right speech and right action in mind, what would be an appropriate thing to say about what happened in Charlottesville?
I don't know. I think that there probably isn't a fully appropriate thing to say. I think each person is going to have their own individual relationship with what they think is compassionate, what they think is right. And there probably isn't one right thing. If you bring it back to, do not harm, and harm is caused, then we need to act and speak in ways that try not to perpetuate harm and violence.
Sherry?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're coming from a place of that you personally feel that there's a value in conflict. Is that true?
I think overall, yes.
Oh, okay. So I think that is probably maybe the most challenging thing you're putting out there.
Okay.
Like that conflict within herself is conflict is a good thing. I think that's a challenge. So I'll say that. But personally, I would say that what happened in Charlottesville was terrible, wrong. I would use the word wrong, destructive, violent, and really, really, really bad and scary. So that's what I would say. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue. What's your name?
Raymond.
Raymond. Okay, Raymond.
I'll speak to my experience in my practice. I'm not quite sure when you say rehabilitation, because for me, what I see, it's about fear. Entering or non-entering, for me, conflict is about fear. Fear of what I might lose, fear of what might happen to me. I think that, at least the way I understand where my practice is going, is being able to identify clearly what is driving my thoughts and my behaviors so that I can choose something better. And I don't know if we define rehabilitation that way, but I have an example. Last week I was at a feminist socialist meeting, and they were talking about Me Too. And they were talking about really big macro things to organize. And I was thinking, how can I participate in that? And then a gentleman there mentioned, we just have to call people out. Every day at work, in our everyday life, when somebody says something unacceptable, we just have to call it out. For me, there is fear in that. For me, that might be realizing that fear and being able to do what I think is skillful is rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I try to do. And I do that. I come to that through this practice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Jeffrey is my name. For starts, I think we need to look at the history of our Sangha, our teachers, and where those teachings come from. Because, in fact, during World War II and before, the entire Buddhist edifice supported Japanese imperialism. They were not neutral. They stepped forward and supported. And in fact, even previous to that, my understanding is that during the early part of the century, the 20th century, there were priests who were interested in social justice. And those priests were exposed by the Buddhist organization, basically turned over to the government and killed. So our Buddhism is just a religion. That means it's got all kinds of mixed elements in it. And we have to decide which are positive and life-affirming and which are not. My attention has been drawn, as many people in this room know, to the fact that if you look around this room, mostly we are white-skinned. And we are of European descent. That flies in the face of the idea that Buddhist liberation is for all. And I think until we deal with that question, we will be causing great harm. I think that dealing with that question means understanding our history as white-skinned people, what that means in the society we live in, and then figuring out with everybody else what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Diana and then Andrea? Okay. And some people over here too. Okay. You all decide who's going to speak. That's too much for me. I can't handle it. you all decide who's going to speak.
I just want to stand up for a question.
Okay.
Yeah. You.
We're going for it? All right. There's this guy named Daryl Davis, who's a black guy who, like, goes and talks to, like, these far-right activists, these KKK supporters, and tries to, you know, get them to realize that he's a person like them, that they don't need to be hateful. And he's been pretty successful. I think he's got, like converted, like, 40 people away from their hate. And to me, I guess it's about relationships and forming relationships with a greater variety of people, even people that, you know, we don't agree with, which I'm a very disagreeable person. I don't agree with a lot of people. So it's about getting out there and forming those relationships and being able to realize both the flaws in yourself and those and other people, and being able to discuss those and come to a truth that's better mutually.
I'd like to say something. The premise that you started with, that Buddhism says that everything is equal, and that is something we need to rehabilitate in Buddhism, I think is a misunderstanding of Buddhism. I don't think it teaches that. I think that when you talk about equality as a teaching in Buddhism, it's a teaching that's coming from the absolute level. And if you bring that teaching into the relative level, in the sense of saying good or bad is all the same, that's a misuse of the fundamental basic teaching. I think you can use equality and say we're all the same, like all life is the same, and that gives us a foundation from which to build on talking with people, but it doesn't mean that everything that people say is the same. And our teacher, Katagiri Roshi, who founded this place, he was very firm on this point. He said it over and over again. You can misuse Buddhism. You can be a really good bank robber. That was his favorite example. You can become really good at robbing the bank, but that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. He also taught very much cause and effect, that everything that you do has some kind of effect. And he said, life is depending on you to act. Everything that you do puts an energy into the system that is going to have an effect. So you have to be really careful about what you do and make sure you're putting something good into the system. Another thing, somebody was talking about fear, and I think one of the things that we do as practitioners is we learn to face our own fear, to understand where our fear comes from, so that we can know what it is that life is expecting us to do and be brave enough to do it and have the courage to do it. And I think a lot of Buddhist practice is about that. It's about getting to know ourselves and understanding why we're afraid. How do we get to this point where we're afraid, and learning that we don't want to be like that. We want to be brave, we want to be confident, we want to know what to do. That's what I'm working on in my life, and I am personally taking it as my responsibility to stand up to people. Every time now I hear somebody in my neighborhood say, like somebody did last week, there was a break-in at somebody's house, and he said, you know, we had a lot of roof work done, and a lot of Hispanics came in, and they built those lower-cost houses down the street, and a lot of blacks came in. And I said, that is not a fair thing to say. And immediately he backed off. He said, yeah, I know. So I'm just, that is my project, is to be brave and to stand up to people. So that's my Buddhist practice.
Thank you. Thank you. Diana, you're going to say something, right? Before you do. Yeah. Before you do. Andrea?
Yes.
Or Andrea. Okay, Andrea. Okay. So you said a couple of things that made me remember to share a couple of resources. So, if you like Buddhist ethics, even if you don't. Now let me bring my relativism. It doesn't matter whether you like it or whether you don't like it, right? This is not about that. Buddhism is also a religion and a philosophy and set of ethics, and people embrace it on different levels. I love this book. This is an introduction to Buddhist ethics by Peter Harvey. I highly recommend it. It's not one of those books where you just sit down and read it from page to page, but lots of really good stuff. And one of the reasons why I want to share this with you is also because in my 2-year experience sitting with the Rogue Zen group, we chanted the Heart Sutra. And I remember thinking, oh, this is really beautiful, until it wasn't. And it was a moment where I had chanted no tongue, no this, no that. And then what came to me automatically was no responsibility. And so it seems to me, if what you're saying, Andrea, is true, then we have to think about the psychology, the Buddhist psychology that goes along with the Buddhist ethics, because when we get... Oh, yeah? Snap. Okay. I think we need to hold them all in order to cultivate a wholeness about ourselves. I don't think that I can hold as true that I don't exist and that also I'm responsible for transforming my fear so that I can be skillful and say the right things. It's hard to hold both of those as true. So how do we integrate all of that? That's another question I have.
Just two quick things. First, I come from a family of, I think, besides me and one other person, are ardent Trump supporters and self-proclaimed. They wear the label proudly themselves, bigots. And so I have lived this. And if they know that, you bring it up to me, because I will say something. And that is, over the years, I've learned to take a lot more compassion than I did at first. Which was outraged, but you were not raised that way. What the heck are you doing? Kind of thing. But also, don't we have some examples from our Buddhist tradition that where there was responsiveness? I don't remember the story, remember what happened, but I remember that the Buddha was challenged because there was some guy out in the woods that was killing people and wearing their thongs.
Right. Angulimala.
So it would be great to hear, what he did and said to this person, and other instances. I can think of other stories where Buddhist priests have done things to be the calming voice and the voice to lead people forward. So it would be great to hear some of those examples and stories to help us model our own behavior.
Thank you. You want to tell the story of Angulimala?
That's all I remember.
Okay, I'll tell you what I know about it.
Okay.
And I know there are different versions of the Angulimala story. It was introduced to us in the Sati Buddhist Chaplaincy Training Program. So we heard about it through that sort of lens. But basically, if my memory serves me correctly, Angulimala was had a reputation throughout the land for being a murderer, a serial killer, and would cut off the finger of everyone he had killed and wear it around his neck, thus Anguli Finger Mala. And either he was trying to get 100 fingers, or there was just this one finger that he just didn't have and really wanted, and it was from the Buddha. So he's chasing the Buddha in the forest and saying, I'm trying to kill you, stop. And the Buddha is moving at a very slow pace. Angulimala is running as fast as he can, and the Buddha is just kind of moving very slowly, and so Angulimala is confused why his speed is not allowing him to catch the Buddha. So he says, stop, stop. And the Buddha says to him, I have stopped. Now you stop. And according to how it's written, Angulimala is surprised by this, or shocked by this, or confused by this. Well, what do you mean? You have stopped because you're moving. And the Buddha says to him, no, by stopping, I mean you need to, you know, you need to transform, you need to change, you need to transform your desire for killing, your bloodlust, and so on. And because, you know, the Buddha was portrayed in the suttas as being possessing magical powers, as well as being charismatic, Angulimala is shocked by this koan. I call it a koan, really, and drops everything. His desire to kill the Buddha, his desire to kill others, and then surrenders himself, all of himself, to the practice, to the way. The Buddha invites him then to become a monastic and brings him into the monastic community where he has the reputation of being a murderer. The monks are not happy. And they proceed to, you know, question the Buddha about his judgment and his wisdom. They isolate and alienate Angulimala. He is treated terribly. And so he says to the Buddha, you know, I thought that by living in this way, I would experience peace and contentment. And if I remember correctly, the Buddha says to him, well, you still have to receive your karma. This is something that you created, right? When he receives his karma and understands that, then when he dies, he goes into to Sita heaven, like that, with a poem. So what's the lesson that we can learn, Diana, from that story?
Well, I think many, many things. And some of the things that I take away from that is the Buddha did not treat like with like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, when I think of my interactions with my family members, that's a big lesson, because it went nowhere fast, you know, and then it goes spiraling.
Mm-hmm.
The change in perspective, the words to try to bring some truth to it helped Angulimala stop, which is what the Buddha was commanding him to do. But there was not an abandonment of Angulimala out wherever he was. It was a bringing in, whether that was figuratively or physically, you know. So there was that, and there was the continued dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all
powerful
things that are important.
Right. So you've got me thinking, can we bring our Buddha nature into potential areas of conflict? In other words, in not meeting, we have to?
Okay.
We have to. We must.
If you are trying to pursue some benefits, then the only way that I found, anyway, that I must be successful, and clinging to results, yeah, here we go. But you know, wanting to do things that are, you know, stopping things that are not beneficial, and encouraging things that are beneficial, that wisdom that Buddhism brings is a pathway to bringing about those things that would be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we can have a certain ethical one. Just one more. Our ethics, our Buddhist ethics, if I'm understanding you correctly, Diana, at least I'm inspired to say this, is that if we have a good sense of Buddhist ethics, which means understanding what causes and conditions have the greatest potential to bring about good versus not good. Okay. Then when we encounter situations, which you say you are living now, we can, through our Buddha nature, if we're cultivating that, actually, like the Buddha in Angulimala, see the potential in people who even have the intention of harming us. This is a hard thing to do, but it's what we're called to do. This is what makes Buddhist practice for me juicy. Juicy. It's one of the reasons why, even after I felt like I had been the victim of racism in the Rogue Zen group, I remained there a year later. It is my habit energy to say, oh, you treated me this way, I'm out. But I decided to stay and endure that pain and stay in relationship to explore more what it was all about. Later I learned that what it was about is that they didn't have an ethic of treating people well. They treated each other poorly. Well, the more I looked at it, it wasn't just about me. They treated each other poorly. So in Buddhism also there's this thing, it's hard to do, and time is coming to an end, time for us to close, is that even when someone is harming you, even if they're cutting you limb by limb, according to the sutta, if you are a deeply committed Buddhist practitioner, you will say to the assailant, as they are harming you, good things about them. That even though you just cut off my right arm, I see in you the potential for transformation. I believe that about you, and that you say that to them. One last comment, and then we'll bring it to a close. I'm sorry, in the interest of time.
Yeah. Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you.
As I listen to the conversation and think about it in kind of the real time, I find I struggle with the challenges of all of the words that are kind of associated with conviction or judgment, compassion, empathy, when looking at, you know, thinking about sorting it all out for myself. How can I have a conviction or an opinion when it feels like there is this dichotomy? And then realizing that I have to sort my own out and realize that others may not be in the same mindset as well. So that causes a lot of challenge and struggle as well. I mean, I don't, you know, what is my purpose? It's not about conversion, but how do I also demonstrate my own opinion in a respectful way, in a non-judgmental way, in a way that doesn't cause harm for myself or others? Mm-hmm. And that, I'm looking for that.
You're looking for... you're looking for the answer that doesn't exist in its entirety to all those questions? You know, I'll say this in closing, that I really believe this is not the time for... when we think about racial justice in particular, not just racial justice. When we think about racial justice, when we think about... equality for transgender people, when we think about making this a safe space, this country, for Muslims and every other targeted group. I mean, pretty much, if you are not down with Trump, you are in a targeted group. That's pretty much how it is, right? So for me, this is not really the time to worry so much about, did I hurt your feelings by saying, I think that this person is worthy of love, compassion, respect? If you have a hard time with that, then I invite you to take care of yourself, right? But in the midst of real threats to others right now, the deportation of hundreds of thousands of people and the threat of deportation of hundreds of thousands of people, there's really literally right now a whitewashing taking place in the United States. If I say to you, I think these people deserve respect, and you're offended by that. I can't take care of you. I can't. That's too much. It just isn't enough to say, I care about people, and I want you to care about people too. I care about you, and I want you to care about me. And if you're offended by that, so be it. But at least I did what I think is our highest purpose. This is all I can say. I think our highest purpose as human beings is to help each other be civil. Because we see if we're not civil, we can tear each other apart. So with that, I say thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation. Thank you for engaging in this conversation. And I hope that we can do something good, okay, and claim it. And claim it as good without ambivalence about that.